Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Ventham, who are both pastors of Christ Church in Hayward Heath. Well, you're in for a real treat, because over the next two podcasts, we'll be talking about God's sovereignty. Graham and Mark recently delivered a series of sermons at Christchurch on the sovereignty of God and how that works out in the world. But this is one of those topics where there are a diversity of views held by different Christians. And so in these two episodes of Ordinary, we are debating two views of sovereignty. That's right, it's going to get real chewy. So let's get into it, and I'll catch you on the other side.
Hi, I'm Mark Ventham. I'm one of the pastors at Christchurch Hayward Heath.
My name's Graham Nichols, and I'm also one of the pastors.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. This week, I'm handing over the reins to Mark when it comes to hosting. We're talking about sovereignty, but for reasons that will become clear, Mark is going to host this episode. Do you want to take over right now, Mark?
I will. So this is the plan. This podcast and the next one, we're going to be thinking about God's sovereignty. And the reason we are, partly we'll explain why, but it's coming from the recently we did a series at Christchurch in our evening series where we worked through, preached through on God's sovereignty. And we thought it'd be a really helpful thing to talk about a little bit more. But here's the thing. This week, we're going to have a little bit of a debate between Graham and Josh, because Graham and Josh have slightly different views on how God's sovereignty works out. And so we thought, instead of Graham and I, who hold the same view, kind of thrashing it through, with Josh trying to ask questions and holding a slightly different view, we thought it'd be easier if I chaired and asked them the questions. So that's what we're going to do. So let's start with the first question, which is, why is it worth talking about God's sovereignty in the first place?
I think it's worth talking about for a couple of reasons. One is to do with God, and one's to do with us. To do with God, I think we talk about it because it's a key attribute of God. Something that we look up and exalt God for is his all-consuming power. So I think it's a thing about God, so it's worth thinking about for that very reason alone. But also, I think it's a very practical subject to talk about. It's practical for us because there's things happening in our lives, and there's service that we're doing, and we need to understand how does that fit. So when bad things happen, when we're serving, when we're praying, when we're evangelizing, how does that work with God's sovereignty? Because I think if we get muddled on that point, we'll become desperate or demotivated, or we'll become arrogant. So I think there's all those things to think about. It's not just practical, though, for us serving as Christians. It's practical for the kinds of questions that people in the world are asking, or of life in general, but of Christians in particular. So in evangelistic Bible studies that I do, it's probably the most common topic area. People will ask about suffering. People will ask about, well, how did God allow this to happen? Not so much to do with suffering, but just a whole narrative of the Bible and evil and Satan and those things. People will ask whether God really does have rights over the world, and often think that he doesn't, and that their rights kind of trump his. So it's a really practical topic. So that's why I think it's worth talking about.
Do you want to add anything on those points there, or why?
I absolutely agree with all that. I think it is one of those topics that does set the context for your view of God, for your view of yourself, for your view of other people. And so I think it permeates into all other areas, like Graham said, with suffering, answers to questions on sin and grace, and God's other attributes are kind of affected by your view of his sovereignty. So I think it is quite a fundamental area.
Okay. Well, let's go into the next thing. Define it for us. How would you define God's sovereignty? Now, at this point, there may not be that much of a disagreement or diversion, but let's go with it. Graham, why don't you give us your...
Yeah, I think God's sovereignty means that he rules with absolute, irresistible, infinite, everlasting power. So that would be my definition of God's
sovereignty.
Any other
big words you can put in there?
I've got that written down, to be fair, so that's not entirely in my head.
I was going to make it out like you just thought that off the top of your head.
But it's the Bible idea that no one can say to God, what are you doing? That he does as he pleases. So there's an absoluteness about his power, that there's no limits to it. It's irresistible in that it can't be stood against. It's infinite in that it's everywhere at all time. And that he rules in that way. I could add a little bit to that.
Well, let's just see, George, do you want to add anything to that clarify?
I don't think so. I think it'll be interesting to see throughout this conversation that we probably use a lot of the same language, but perhaps have a slightly different dictionary when it comes to what we mean by those words.
Yes.
But I wouldn't necessarily disagree with any of that definition.
Now, it's worth saying at the upfront that actually as we talk about this area, as both views come out, there is mystery on both sides. So in other words, because God is God and we're not God, we're not going to understand fully all of this. So what we're trying to do is make sense of what the Bible teaches, of our understanding of who God is and how that works out. And we cannot fully comprehend it. The same way I can't fully comprehend the Trinity, or how Jesus can be both fully human and fully God. There is mystery. And so I think it's worth saying that up front. Now, probably where the differences really kind of spin out in the viewpoints and would be around what is labelled free will, how we understand free will in and of itself. So do you want to go first, Josh, because you probably would be much more, free will would be the language that you would use much more, and kind of just spell out a little bit your thinking on this.
Yeah, so... Well, what I'd like to say from the outset is that I totally agree with what you said, which is that I don't think either side of this debate are correct 100%. That, you know, that if you look at the Arminian side, that it's not correct. You look at the Calvinist side, it's not correct fully. You know, they might have good things in them, but they can't even begin to scratch the surface of God's infinity on these issues. And so I prefer to look at these issues with the lens of which is the least wrong, or which seems to chime with the Bible's description of reality the best, not which is right, because we know they're not going to be right 100%.
Yes.
I think there, from my point of view, there are good reasons to think that theistic determinism, Calvinism, is false. And I think...
what do you mean by theistic determinism? Because they're kind of big words. Theistic God, determinism.
That God has unilaterally decided... what every action and thought throughout history shall be, will be.
So you would hold that God, in that sense, isn't sovereign over every detail?
That he has chosen in his sovereignty that man should have the free choice. So I think A.W. Tozer has a good quote on this, which is that the eternal decree of God, determine not which choice that man should make, but that he should be free to make it. So I'm not saying or suggesting that God is not sovereign. I'm suggesting that in his sovereignty, he decrees that man should have free choice. So that when I exercise my free choice, I'm not infringing upon his sovereignty. I'm actually working it out.
But by free choice as well, you mean, don't you, this what is libertarianism, free will? In other words, the power of contrary choice. That is, the individual can choose without any other factors affecting it. Desires, nature, a free choice, totally free, independent of anything else. Is that right?
Not quite as strong as that, but my personal view wouldn't be quite as strong as that. So I'm not saying at all that any choices are entirely free of influence. That's clearly not the case. In reality, we're influenced by all kinds of things. Even my geographical location is going to influence or affect the way I can choose.
But when it comes to choosing God, all of that, in one sense, the choice has to be, if I am to choose God in salvation, it is free of all such things. So although those influences are there, in the heart of it, I am choosing freely.
At the heart of it, I believe that a person has the choice to choose A or not A. And in identical circumstances, they could, in fact, have chosen other than which they did. Yes.
Okay.
Now, I think it's a different conversation when we're talking about salvation as opposed to what I choose f- for breakfast, that those are slightly different, you know.
Sure.
But that ultimately, yes, human agents have free choice, and that in any scenario, they are free to choose A or not A, if that makes sense.
But it's not that it's just that they're free to choose A or A, that it's independent of any other outside influence, previous events, desires, nature. I mean, I think that's key to it, isn't it? In my understanding of power of country, it's completely independent.
To an extent, I don't think that we're saying that free will means that every time you make a choice, it is completely uninfluenced.
No,
that's just not
reality.
But with
regard to salvation,
yes.
In other words, yes, people may influence me, yes, but it's detached from my sinful nature, from my desires.
I think that's a slightly different question. Is it detached from my sinful nature? Again, I would just fall back on, yes, I believe that each individual has the real opportunity to make a decision of faith or against faith, that God's prevenient grace is offered to all mankind, that each human being made in the image of God is loved by God, that God genuinely has, his will is that all should be saved, that he has that desire, and that opportunity is afforded to each person. Now, I'm not a universalist, and neither are either of you. So the question becomes, well, why isn't everybody saved? And the answer to that question for me is because some choose to reject that grace.
So when we talk about election, mm-hmm. how would you understand election in light of free will?
Well, primarily as a corporate idea, and secondarily as an individual idea. So that God elects for himself a people.
Corporately,
as he did in the Old Testament, Israel are his elect. Not necessarily meaning that every individual who is an Israelite is saved. It was no guarantee. Or that others who were not Israelites could not be saved. I mean, Job's a good example of that, isn't he? Job was not an Israelite, and yet he clearly has a relationship with God. So that is not a free ticket to salvation, but that God's election is primarily corporate. And whether you become part of that group or not is based on your response in faith or not. So, for example, you might say to us in church, there will be a group going to the Natural History Museum or the British Museum to look at all the exhibits on Egypt and go through this talk with somebody, and that is going to happen. There's a group that's going to go and do that. But whether or not you're part of that group is still up for grabs.
Let's bring Graham in on this point. So give us an understanding from your side. It's the view that we've preached recently.
To do with free will, you mean?
Free will, and then onto election, because these things are connected, aren't they?
Yes, yeah. Just to continue to say this, that there is mystery in this, and that I think it's unbiblical to say that God is not sovereign. So I don't think there's value in talking about, well, is he or isn't he? I think it's all about how that operates, and whether this kind of notion that in some sense he sort of subcontracts out history to us and stands back from it, which is really what Josh is saying, that there's a kind of, God continues to be sovereign, but somehow he sort of, you know, withdraws and allows kind of things to play out with no influence from him at all. So I would say that doesn't seem to be both either a biblical view or a kind of a logically coherent view. In terms of the will, there is some sort of common ground in that. I think the way the Bible speaks about the responsibility for our choices and the consequences of our choices being played out, I think it's, we would say, yes, there is an operation of the will, and we're making real choices in terms of our own experience. I think probably the different layer that we would put on it is that our wills are taken captive by sin, by our inherited sin, by our habitual sin. And so we do end up doing what we want to do, what we genuinely want to do. But what we want to do, particularly in this area of salvation, is that we don't want God to rule over us. So we need God to do something in a spark, an insight, a realization and in a bringing to life of us that will then give us the freedom to choose to be saved, to choose to repent, to choose to follow Christ. So there's something that God needs to do.
That sounds very Arminian at this point. It sounds like Josh's prevenient grace that you're talking about there. And is that what you're in terms of spark? Or?
No, it's just the reason I used spark was actually that A.W. Pink in Sovereignty of God, who could in no way be described as an Arminian, actually uses that expression, which I thought okay. was quite helpful in the sense that I mean, he also maps out all the other areas in which God is sovereign. So he doesn't think that there's just this spark and then God wanders off. But I think it's the point that there is a moment or moments of insight where God kind of intervenes, particularly to give life. I think that's what he means by spark, you know, the spark of life, that he gives spiritual life. And I would understand from the Bible that our wills are in bondage, as Luther would say, they're taken captive until God intervenes in that way. And I think God's intervention is something that he has chosen to do in love at some point outside of time. Now, bear in mind, I have no explanation for how God operates outside of time and what the perspective of God outside of time even means. So in all the Bible language, it's always using language that accommodates to our terminology. So to say that God loved me before the foundation of the world is in time language. What that actually means in the economy of God, I have no clue. Because if you take the proposition, which I think is reasonable, that God stands outside of time and sees the end from the beginning in one perspective, I can't imagine what that means. But it's not a before in a strict sense, in that there's this timeline which is all of history, you know, since creation, and then there's a before which is just on a graph just before that. And I think that's a good way to think about God's before. But in as much as God has given me the language to use, the language says there was a point that he determined to set his love on me for no merit of my own, and he loved me and he chose me, and he affects that by releasing my will from the bondage of sin in order to follow him.
So typically you'll say God elects, he chooses before the creation of the world,
yes.
Ephesians 1,
yeah.
To not just corporately a people, but individuals. So he's choosing who to go in that group to the British Museum.
Yes.
And he elects and sets his love on them. And then at a point in history, he brings that spiritual life to bear, this spark, by Fisher turning the heart in order to, or giving them a new heart, Ezekiel language, that is enables them then to choose him freely.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not sure the corporate helps too much, because even if you take the Old Testament as being more corporate, there's clearly a choosing of Israel above all other nations. And that choosing is not based on their merit. So it's not based on their approach to him. It's based on his approach to them. And I think that in a way... Even if you could argue that sort of corporately, I think you can, for in the Old Testament, it's still the same issue, really, of God's sovereign choice. I chose Israel because I just chose them. I just loved them. I set my love on them. I chose them. They're my chosen people. And they have this amazing dignity over and above all the other nations. And it wasn't about their merit. It wasn't about their choice. It was about my choice. And that's a corporate thing.
There's so many issues there that we could talk about, but just to go back a little bit, I think that firstly, I wouldn't want people to think that my view is that God, as you kind of, I think, caricatured it, that God winds up the toy and lets it go and then is completely hands off. I don't think that's the view. I don't think that's what genuine freedom means. I think that I totally think that God interacts in the world. I think that he is present and that he even many times overrides and feeds a new event in, as Lennox would say. So that's not my view. I think it's interesting that you characterized my view as potentially illogical, but didn't perhaps flesh that out. I'd like to understand why you think that. But then I guess what I'd like to think about is really where the rubber hits the road here is that does your view mean that human beings are held responsible for a decision for which they did not have the ability to choose otherwise? Does your view therefore entail that God is the author of sin, is the language that's often used in the criticism. Does that mean that when God chooses some and passes over others, that he doesn't really offer, that salvation is not a real genuine opportunity for all human beings? Does God really have a universal salvific will in that way? And I think there's many difficulties like this that need answering. And here's the thing. I think that ultimately the reason that I don't sit on that side of the fence, on your side of the fence, is because I think that there are too many questions that are raised by this view which are too fundamental for me to be comfortable with, and that the questions that are raised by my view, which might be, okay, so how does God get his sovereign will, how does that work out in a world of free creatures, that's difficult. Yep, that's difficult. I don't understand God's sovereignty. I believe he's able to do it, and I'll talk about how I think that's actually a bigger view of sovereignty in a minute. But I'll sit with that issue rather than sit with the issues of which I think you are, if you're honest, left with, which are, well, what does God's love really mean then? Because it doesn't seem to mean what we think it means. What does God's justice really mean then in this economy? Because it's not what we think naturally that it means. And I think that these attributes of God are rationally intelligible. I think it matters what you're saying about God and his character. And if it is not recognisably good, not recognisably loving, that is an issue that's going to cause us to question whether that is the right view to have of God.
Yeah, I understand all those objections. And I think in a way the difference is that, I know we haven't spoken about this so much, but we would say that there are not two parallel universes, but there are two principles in operation where God is sovereign over everything, and he is not contingent on our decisions in order for his sovereign will to operate. But at the same time, he holds us fully responsible for what we do, and that we make real choices. And I think the difference in a way is that what you're seeking to do is to find a way to reconcile those things, and in a way where we're just leaving them out there. I know you might sort of find that uncomfortable, but we're not actually taking it to the degree that we're both caricaturing each other's opinion in a way to make a point, and so I apologize for caricaturing yours. I suppose we have I have a number of kind of milestone points, not milestone points, but foundational points to say, my understanding is God says he's completely sovereign over everything. When I say about my logical coherence bit, it's that I can't figure out how God could operate his complete sovereignty and then somehow stand back from it and stuff to happen that he's not comfortable with, to use a very humanizing term, that he still is God, and yet stuff is happening that he has no control over. I can't see that's possible for God to do that. So that's where my logical incoherence comes.
And that's more logically incoherent for you than saying that God determines those things that he's not comfortable with. And that also, whilst that's happening, the people who do those things are actually responsible, even though God determined it.
No, I'm saying that...
I feel like...
I'm saying that, I've just to finish point, I've got a much narrower perspective, because I'm not sitting in eternity determining why, for the glory of God, has he determined a whole load of things to happen. I'm also actually saying I don't know quite how it all kind of operates. Because as we'll probably talk about in the next one, you know, God uses ordinary means and so forth. And in practice, apart from the emotion of it, I think we end up in the same place as to what we do as Christians, both you and I. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying I don't actually understand entirely how it all operates, but I don't want to deny what God has said. Mm-hmm. He is sovereign. I don't want to deny what God has said. He has sovereignly chosen me. I don't want to deny what God has said is that we are responsible for our choices, and we willingly and responsibly and culpably reject him. And I just stand back then and say, I can't really reconcile these guys. those two things perfectly. And maybe I never will. But
neither can I, by the way. No, I'm not claiming to.
Yeah.
I think as I stated at the start, the question is not which of our views is right.
Yes.
D.A. Carson had a good quote, which was, it's no answer to tell me that my presentation of the sovereignty responsibility tension still embraces certain unresolved tensions. Of course it does. Yes. If you wish to convince me that your theology is essentially more Christian than my own, you must show me how your shaping of the tension better conforms to the biblical data than mine.
Yes.
That's the point of this conversation, isn't it? That's the point of theology.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. There clearly is a tension. And I don't think either of us are claiming to know exactly how it works. I think the question is which conforms better to the biblical data.
Yeah, but I think if the text we return to, obviously there's the really obvious ones in Ephesians, but one we went back to quite a few times was in Isaiah, where he's talking about what he's going to determine in the history of the nations sort of immediately around Israel. And he says, remember, I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none like me. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. I say my purpose will stand and I will do all that I please. So God is saying, I am completely deterministic in the whole of history. And I have this ability to survey, because I'm God and there's no one like me, I can survey the whole of history from beginning to end. And I know, and my purpose in that will stand.
Agreed.
I can't conceptualize a God who can say that and then say, but it really depends what people choose.
No, I agree with you, Graham.
I'm raising up this king, but he might decide not to.
But you also cannot conceptualise, if you're honest, how you could be responsible for an act that's been predetermined. So that cuts both ways, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting, though. Why would you prefer it that in this sense, God limits his sovereignty in order to give us free choice, which to me sounds far scarier than saying, actually, no, God is sovereign. He's ruled in all matters. And you're saying, actually, no, I want to limit God's sovereignty. So in the sense of he gives over us this choice, which somehow eliminates him from being the author of evil, in your view, which to my mind doesn't make sense because he's still limiting his sovereignty, and so in giving that choice he's saying in effect I know what will happen anyway, or if he doesn't know what will happen then his sovereignty isn't that big or that great. And I don't think you would agree with that. You would say he does know what will happen. So in giving that choice, mm-hmm. he is allowing mm-hmm. evil into his world. He is effectively
the potential for evil,
yes, but he knows what's going to happen.
Yep.
So therefore he is the author of it,
not the cause.
But we wouldn't say he is. Mm-hmm. But that's in other words, you're just expressing the same truths, but locating them much more on the human side, whereas I guess we would locate things much more on the divine side.
Yes, and that's where I have a problem. So it's a good question. Why is free will so important? Okay, and so C.S. Lewis has a really nice quote again, which is, why then did God give them free will? Because free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. That's why it matters. That's why it's important. And again, I would like to say that I'm not limiting God's sovereignty. I'm saying that, as Tozer kind of brings out in that quote, that it's God's sovereignty that allows for free will. God's sovereignty
decrees.
But he's
limiting it.
Yes,
I agree.
Absolutely. Yes, yes, I agree. God limits his control, his level of control. Yeah. He says, I'm going to respect human beings as free agents, as moral agents to make decisions, and in that the responsibility for sin, like you said, yes, I'm putting at the feet of man, not at the feet of God. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's podcast. We actually had an hour-long discussion, but we've cut that into two podcasts, so we'll pick up at that point next week. In a few weeks' time, we're hoping to do a Q&A podcast. So if you have any questions, maybe this podcast has inspired some questions for you, then please send them to ordinary@cchh.org.uk. Thanks for listening. Come back next week for the second half of our conversation on sovereignty.